The Killing Type, a novel by Wayne Jones. Chapter 3. W is for Winton, as Ms. Grafton might put it, if she ever gets that far in the alphabet and starts substituting proper names for the generic crime-related words she has favored up till now. A week ago, a man named Stephen Winton was discovered dead in the front seat of his red 1995 Acura Integra. Quote, the one with the 160 horsepower VTEC engine, unquote, as a newscast put it, appealing to which segment of the potential viewership, I have no idea. He had been shot twice, or rather, a gun had been shot into his car twice. One broke the driver's side window, just missed the headrest, and lodged in the cushion of the back seat. The other entered the top of the left side of his head, right at the border of his hairline and his forehead, proceeded down through his brain and came out through his ear. And the puzzle is that the police can't find that second bullet. At least that's the rumor I heard from the raver. The investigation is, as they say and said, ongoing. The police are starting to do the obvious math, and it's not adding up right in a small town like this. Here's what the chief of police said at the news conference yesterday. Quote, we don't get many murders here, and so we're going on the theory for now that these are two were committed by the same person, unquote. He looked nervous there on the dais, fidgety, perhaps not used to quite so many reporters, maybe 30 little tape recorders crowded around the base of his microphone like enthusiasts at a rally. I watched the whole thing only on television, and I could see the worry in his eyes, not just from the fact of a second murder, but from the details that he was not explaining to the masses. That is, it's unlikely that the two victims were killed by the same person, because a serial killer, even one who kills, quote, unquote, just a couple of people, tends not only to use more or less the same method of killing, but also to use more tactile methods such as stabbing, and not cold and distant ones like shooting. Quote, serial killers avoid firearms whenever possible because they are such an impersonal way to kill, unquote, as one of the premier authorities on serial killing and mass murder puts it. His name is Elliot Layton in the book Hunting Humans. Perhaps I am just contriving the look on the police officer's face in my own head. Maybe he is always like that, a nervous sort, shy in crowds, more comfortable in smaller groups or in the office, doing the legwork of an investigation rather than acting as a spokesperson. Maybe, as some of the ingrates used to say about me at TU, maybe I am making too much of a little thing. Still, among the skills that one learns as a scholar that are applicable even remotely to what is affectionately known as the real world is a keen penchant for close observation. In the literary texts which I have edited, for example, I have prided myself not only on my indefatigable research in both primary and secondary sources and my resultant comprehensive knowledge of the particular period under study, but also on my attention to the details of proofreading. At Oxford University Press, some of the production editors styled me comma man for my unstinting abilities, proof after proof, and the series editor, the TU department head in better days, touted me embarrassingly in my evaluation, recommending me without hesitation for promotion from assistant to associate professor. How things change. I have to confess that I miss the true academic life. It feels crude some days, roiling in the dregs of details about murder and the fear and upheaval it has caused in this small town. Scholarly research is a cleaner and much more humane pursuit, and the discoveries contribute to the fund of civilized knowledge. When you are writing a book about murder, discovery is a dreadful and dreary process. Details about obscenities inflicted upon bodies, a widow shaking her head when the reporter asks her, "How does it feel?" Sometimes the quest to dig out the facts and to marshal them into some comprehensible whole is just too tiring and depressing, even for a committed researcher such as myself. I flail around, figuratively, try to distract myself with serendipitously found games on the internet, or search out specific keywords on anything other than murder. My background research on Mr. Winton, an orgy of activity entailing interviewing tight-lipped cops at one end and poring over positively horrific forensic science texts at the other, left me feeling dazed and pummeled. Occasionally, during the darkest moments, I wonder whether I have the stamina for this, the stomach. I remembered how much pleasure I had at Toronto U in what now seemed like outrageously innocent pursuits, ferreting out some fact about the watermarks and composition of the first edition of Samuel Johnson's Rambler, or studying parody in the works of Swift. There were frustrations with that research too, but they were mostly small things, such as, during one particularly memorable morning when it was raining, the absolute refusal of the curator of rare books and manuscripts to let me view some hard-to-find editions because of the mere technicality of my expired library card. I had to resort to a child's simple language in order to describe a few of the basic, ghastly facts about Winton's death. First, the hole that a bullet makes when it comes out of the human body is much bigger than the one that it makes when it enters. Have you ever seen that high-speed photo of a bullet shot through an apple, the one taken by Harold E. Edgerton at MIT in 1964? The effect in a human head is more pronounced than that, even. A tiny hole, more or less the size of a bullet on entry, and a large, what they call, exit wound on the other side. The reports in the media always tend to underemphasize, if not studiously avoid, this kind of information, a practice I have never quite understood. Expose people to the filthy practicalities of violence, and soon the culture would not be inured and complacent, but would raise its voice and enforce justice on the perpetrators. The letters in the Gazette tend towards anger and sadness instead of fear. The focus of most is on the widow and 9-year-old son that Winton's murder left behind. Quote, "My heart goes out to Cecilia Winton and her little boy Jack. I just can't comprehend what monster would do something like this. How can there possibly be a reason for this? And why haven't the police been able to track this person down?" Unquote. There was also, quote, "Society is really starting to break down when there are killings at all. One human taking another's life, but when that is done with apparent randomness, when there is no reason, if one can say something that heinous, then we must truly be in the end days." Unquote. And then the topper from Ryan, also 9. Quote, "Jack was my best friend and now I don't get to play with him anymore. My mom and dad, who I love very much, tell me that there are bad people in the world, people who hurt other people. But I don't know why anyone would want to hurt Jack's dad, because he was a really nice man and took us for walks along the lake and then bought us ice cream." Unquote. The next day, a bright Saturday when I awaken at 10:45, but eventually deteriorating to cloud and coolness and rain by the time I have finished chores and latte. The next day I seek a kind of solace among simple people doing simple things. A man is dead, a second murder victim, but there are still fake-tanned older mothers selecting extra old cheddar at the outdoor market. I wonder if they are as shocked as I am, as assaulted, and hope to right themselves by at least pretending to be living in a normal town on a normal day. I am not having much success. No matter how much I walk, no matter how charming a little corner I find on whatever historic bench with just the right amount of shade and dappled sunshine, I'm not able to shake a pervasive nervousness, a tension which gripped me when I read the first headlines and got worse as I absorbed more and more details. A sense of longing develops, builds, subsides, rises again with added strength. A longing for simpler times as an obscure academic in a big anonymous city. I feel too exposed here, among the merchants selling emu products, the farmer still in her dirty jeans and knee-high rubber boots, the father walking slowly to his illegally parked minivan with just enough berries and other goodies to suffice for dessert after the evening's barbecue. I fear that the killer with that same gun could be headed my way, headed for this entire group. I have a frisson of realization that he may be primed now to move from one-at-a-time serial killing to mass murder, giving up the soliloquy for the crowded bloody stage. I tremble next to the display of LPs already shot through and now reduced to a dollar each. There has been a rough choreography of emotion over the past few days on the radio and television, in the newspaper, on the street. The snippets that I've witnessed are mostly anger and fear, which, as any psychological quack with the slightest of BAs will tell you, are both the same thing. Just as the macho man with the illiberal views and the tendency towards personal vigilantism is a weak little simp on the inside, many of those who are ranting angrily are really doing so out of fear. I do not criticize this fear, of course, but I have to admit that the anger can be wearing. Sincere emotions tend to come from the deep, quiet center of a person, and is manifested with a dignity and integrity which the media, quote, personalities, do not even approach. As I pass by a table of overdone turquoise jewelry, I hear my name called. I flinch that it might be the raver, but it turns out to be an attractive, husky-voiced young woman whom I can't quite place. Yes, hello. My name's Rachel, from the public library, you know, the main branch. I've helped you with some of your research. Oh, yes, I recognize you now, I lie. Please forgive me, I guess it must be seeing you out of context. I smile at her to indicate something friendly. I do remember now that she was in fact quite helpful, steering me away from false leads and introducing me to sources of information that I hadn't been aware of. It's scary, she says. Scary? The murders. Oh, yes, right, yes. Though I guess the police... I let the sentence trail off, suddenly realizing I'm not quite sure what I wanted to say about that. Are the police on the verge of arresting someone? Are they incompetent? I don't think they've caught anyone, right? She asks, saving me. No, that's what I hear on the news anyway. She smiles awkwardly, as if the tidbit of information only this side of polite conversation is somehow disturbing. A car goes by and it startles her. She squeals in a very appealing fashion. I'm sorry, she says, a little nervous, I guess. This thing has got me spooked. It's understandable, I say. People have been killed. What do you think it's all about? I mean, who's doing this? She laughs nervously. Well, if I knew that, my book would be very short and I would go to the police right away. She laughs again, this time more relaxed. I guess maybe I just lack imagination or something, she says. I mean, I work in a library and I read a lot of books, mysteries even, but I can't even begin to imagine who the killer is, what kind of man, what kind of person, I guess, what kind of person would do something like this. I finally have a chance to examine her more closely as she looks around, as if for her next halting sentence, as if for the murderer. And the thing that strikes me is that she is a jumble of contrasts, an elegant black jacket, but shabby shoes, a bad haircut, but makeup applied with subtlety and meticulousness. Listen, I say, sounding more imperious than I intend, are you going to be in on Saturday at the library? She nods. Perhaps after my research we could go get a coffee or something and discuss the case. Not that I know anything in particular, but I think that it might be interesting to exchange thoughts. That would be wonderful. I look at my watch, crudely, I am afraid, and for no particular reason, and she takes the unintended cue. You're busy, but it's been nice talking to you, and I'll see you on Saturday. I'm there from 9 to 4. She walks away resolutely at first, determined, After about 10 meters, she turns to see whether I am still there, still watching her. Her eyes go down to the ground then, and she turns back around very quickly and makes her way down the street. I sense an odd, what to call it, victory, as if I have won this particular battle.